Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another star-studded episode of the Art and Labor Podcast.
Yes.
This is a very unique episode, as we are joined here today by our very first official guest. Would you like to announce yourself?
My name is Matthew Thurber, and I'm very excited and happy to be here.
Oh my god.
And we are super fucking stoked that you're here. We're too excited.
I couldn't even do the intro. I was so excited because so y'all might know Matthew from a beautiful history of DIY performance and comics and various titles from the now defunct Picture Box, like 1-800-MICE and Infomaniacs. And now, of course, his new book from John and Quarterly, Art Comic. Me and Lucia, very excited about Art Comic. It's extremely our shit.
I read it and I died.
Awesome. You came back. That's good. You went through the descent into the underworld.
Yes. Did you eat God?
I did when I found out it was easy. Like, really, really bite-sized God.
Yeah, that's the weird Jodorowsky trippy part of the book. Or the, like, Nietzschean part, coming back from the dead.
Yeah, there definitely saw some Jodorowsky. And then Lucia saw another film parallel with that Swedish director.
My favorite director, Roy Anderson.
Oh yeah, Songs from the Second Floor.
Yeah, but I was really thinking of a pigeon. A pigeon sat on a branch and contemplated existence was like the third film in the trilogy, but they had this scene where it was like a Swedish monarch or something, like Charles the 12th comes into a bar. And it reminded me of the pigs, because it was this like really like suited admiral style group that just busts into other people's realities.
Yeah, I think like the cross cutting of reality is like pretty important to me, like interference. I've been thinking a lot, even like doing these tours stops, about having a lecture with interference patterns overlaid onto it. But also, like, it's a book with all these messages, so I have sort of a self-doubt about getting the message out, I guess.
But, I mean, it spoke to me and Lucia. I'll speak for myself first, but I kind of flipped when I read the page that took place in Art Forum, because I worked there for 4 years, and also mentioned the Kuhn Studio, which Lucia worked at for a good amount of time.
Yeah, you texted me a photo of that page, and talking about like there's 30 workers over at the Kuhn Studio that are trying to unionize, and like, well, that's a story. Like, wow, it's our lives on the same page.
It was really
wild.
Like, yeah,
there's just so much that's like trying to collage in from real life, but then, you know, make a totally paranoid hysterical version of reality. But there's like all this
the art world is so ridiculous that when you describe it to people, they don't believe you. Like, we were in I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say this on mic.
Say it, because
we can always edit it out. Okay, we were in the car to Indianapolis, and Lucia was telling a story about how she was at work once, and then like then the boss got into a helicopter. And flew away.
That doesn't happen in just every job. That doesn't happen if you're like, you know, working at the front desk at Home Depot, I guess. But you know, the art world has like this. This like reaches up so high to the highest elite, and then so down low to the like most.
It's all encompassing.
Poverty, you know.
Yeah, because it's like, it really is like, you know, we're on this scrappy road trip, like trying to like scrimp and save, and our friend like saved our ass, drove us, and it was really nice, and he was later like, I was like saying something, and he was like, "Wait, Lucia was talking about Jeff Koons in the helicopter? Like that was real?" And I was like, "Yeah, that was real.
Yeah, that actually happened. Like he takes helicopters to things he has to go to.
He has to. He has to be here and there. I mean, that's the thing. I think one thing that maybe attracts artists is like the idea that you can be fluid through different economic strata. Like you can consort with the. You're supposed to be like sort of a scumbag who can consort with the, you know, the royalty. That's what, that's like one myth.
Well,
like,
yeah, that's that myth, or the quote that's like artists can slip into all classes of society and are therefore the most dangerous or whatever quote that is. But
they can kind of, or they,
some of them can.
Yeah, right. Some people, some golden ones are chosen to have that ability. And I don't know. That's a lot.
Right.
Think about right there. Like, what is that? Is that what you want? Is that what anybody wants as an artist? You want to just rise up?
Right. Or you're golden for a year and then you're not, or something like that, too. Like, happens all the time. I don't know.
That's why those pigs were so great, though, because it was like, oh, right. We could just be making art for ourselves, and we should be making art for ourselves, and what would that even look like? And then having that, I don't want to give too much away or anything. I feel like nothing is going to give it away, because if we reference the comic, it's still going to be so far out, people have to see it.
Yeah, there's like a narrative thread in the comic that we haven't even touched on yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the pigs are totally like, I guess they're like, you know, they had a warehouse together. They're kind of like this anarchist scrappy collective.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure it out. They're like trying to figure it out. So they're always quarreling with each other about what the best way to make art is.
Yes.
And they're very angry. And so like there's a lot of characters like that in the book who are just trying to figure it out. Usually sort of, you know, metaphors for like the left, you know, trying to quarrel and be like, how should we ethically, you know, continue to make stuff? Should we like throw it out on the street? Our art is like manure. We throw it out on the streets. No, we do this. So they're battling each other. But the pigs, yeah, I guess like the main concept of the pigs is like whatever they do, no matter how destructive, and they want to destroy art gallery. Eventually they just smash their brick house into art galleries and destroy them. But that gets reabsorbed into the marketplace. So that can be sold to just like conceptual art.
Right.
And can eventually was like turned into, you know, turned into value. So actually like that main, like kind of the main concept of the book is like about the creation of value or like even the art world. It's not even really about the art world in a way. It's like, that's a metaphor for like value creation or wealth generation.
Yeah, we kind of talk about on this show sometimes that the art world is a really interesting like microcosm of how capital works in a broader sense, right? It'll just like through like neoliberal capitalism, like they can always like find some way to buy and sell and market anything, any struggle, any like identity, any like thing. They can construe it into capital, and the art world is similar. Like any quote, like idea, any like concept, like you think you're making outside of like the dynamics of like economics or like labor relations, but you are not. It's just like, oh, the art market will absorb it and find a way to absorb it somehow.
Yeah, I think like in the book that became like a joke of the concept of the ready-made being like
so
starting from like, you know, Marcel Duchamp like pranking the art world and saying like, I designate this as art, and like it's kind of like a half joke because it's also like you can put anything into the system, into the gallery, you know. What I joke in there is like the museum educational auction house industrial complex. You can put anything into that system and it does create wealth and value and like investment value. And like,
yeah.
So that's just the way the system works.
Yeah.
And it's like just the way that like property works and like flipping houses works.
Right.
and all that gentrification work. So like, yeah, that it's only like after I've got it done, I'm like, okay, this is kind of like, I tried to make like this book, this funny book about the art world, and it ended up being about, really, it's just kind of like about this capitalist system.
No, it's really serious. That's, I think, what I don't know. That's,
I think, like, I don't know, going back to the whole Duchamp thing as like a progenitor of this new and terrible conflagration of capital and like absolute nonsense becoming value, like that's why we kind of, we were joking about him in one of the really earliest episodes of him being a centrist or something in terms of like the art revolutionaries of the world. He really was this person that enabled us to like usher in neoliberalism instead of like having, but we're still like taught to consider him as this person who made like a wormhole in the spectrum of value that you can sort of now like fetishize industrial objects in the same way, and you can like, you can be the arbiter of value or something. But really it was like, wow, thank you for actually like, thank you for capitalism, really. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like, he's just more of like an interesting thinker and everything kind of like followed him. Like, I wouldn't put any responsibility necessarily. Like, I think it started out as a prank, and like, I like his logic systems and the large glass and all that.
Oh, I love the large glass. I think the large glass is like one of the most interesting works to me. The reason Fountain is so annoying to me is that, one, it's probably wasn't even him who did
it.
It was a little vampire.
It was two women who
got no credit.
We don't even know their names.
Beatrice Wood, maybe.
Beatrice Wood, like, or like,
well, now
like his
like
countless
a,
muses that he's gone through. Like, even with his last piece, his final work, the, what is it, Les Enfants or whatever. Like, all of that is, like, just to do with, like, yeah, Les Enfants dans.
The one where you peephole, the peephole one.
Yeah, the peephole one. Was, like, his, like, oh, what's her name? Like, Marie something from Brazil. I don't know. It's just, like, the way these dudes, like, just sort of were using the women in their life, like tissues is always going to, like, color the work. But I think, like, our main problem with him is that is like, it was kind of about like finding a way to package art, which then inspired Warhol, who is our real enemy.
I like them both a lot, but the thing is, like, when people, like, when Duchamp is talking about retinal art and like the kind of the how the intellect is higher than the retinal, the that to me is a rejection of the handmade and a rejection of labor, and so that paves the way, that concept, which I think he was just like, I want to be idle and smoke cigars and like hang out, and I think that's kind of a interesting radical position. Like, he didn't really want to work.
Who
wants to work, but
I like the people who don't want to work.
Yeah, slack. Let's be slack.
Slackmaster.
Like,
Bob Dobbs.
Yeah, Bob Dobbs.
Yeah.
Like, what that led to is a license for, like, then Jeff Koons or anybody who makes all their art, who has all their
art
fabricated.
It's just there's a narrative thread there from Duchamp to Jeff Koons. But it's mostly Andy Warhol to Jeff Koons, I'd say. But, like,
it's hardly, like, It's here nor there, because at the end of the day, we've just been able to identify certain figures who enable a collector base to make a more substantial investment. Because if you make a series of ready-mades, you can have like 5, 10, 12 shovels that you you can turn into an exorbitant amount of profit easily through this conceptual process. But I really liked the way that you went back into the whole fish bar era, where the style of like artists hanging out in taverns in all of these different clans, and like, oh, there's the studio, the gorilla people or something that are like the labor painter folks who think like it's important to gesso something correctly, and then there's like the people who are really creating a hierarchy with themselves on top, saying conceptual art is somehow more inherently valuable because of this like Duchamp rhetoric.
Yeah, that's like a scene from Max's Kansas City. And I worked in this art gallery and they were having a show of artwork based on it. And I kind of had it pounded into my head and was thinking about the mythology of that. And I guess Smithson would just hang out at Max's Kansas City and kind of hold court. And that idea of like, I'm an arbiter of like who's cool and who's not. So like made my professor like from Cooper Union sort of like getting browbeaten or actually beaten with a glass in the face by him. So inventing these sort of like glassed psychotic fantasies about artists is just to me like adding to this. Actually, what I like about art is like when there are all these conflicting, spasming, you know, art groups with manifestos and like people at the 20s and cafe culture and bar culture, I think is really great. Like that's where conflict, I think, is better than like, let's say, you know, armed militia groups fighting each other. I would rather have artists like being, a lot of the book is about like what, you know, conflict is, or what I don't know, being violent is versus, you know, like kind of like will and empathy, like conflicting or something like that. And these weird scenes where artists are beating each other up.
Yeah. I mean, I like that about art too. I like that about zine fairs in particular. I like going to a place and cultivating communities and like schools of thought. But I think capitalism has become so coercive, or like maybe it's late capitalism, but like that I just feel like that where we exist now, it's not even really possible to maintain those sort of tight-knit I don't know, circles of friends, like really getting into it. Everybody is like, well, you have to be nice to everybody because it's really hard out there. And like,
yeah. And thus you can't criticize anybody. Yeah. And yeah, that was kind of the idea behind making this paranoid version of it. Like, I've been talking a lot about like Salvador Dali's like paranoid critical.
Oh my God.
Double,
yes,
image, where it's like, because yeah, you can't just go up and say this stuff. Well, you could, but no one does.
Yeah.
Only if you're on a paranoiac's quest are you allowed to expose the underbelly of, yes, the libidinous natures in humanity.
I mean, I wish that was people talked like exactly like you were talking more frequently, but usually it's like, hey, how's it going? Yeah, we're all like kind of friends, yeah, but we don't know each other. We're all sort of competing for the same blah, blah, blah. And everybody has to be, it's who's more CEO-like in their,
right,
in their dealings. That's who gets rewarded.
And the art schools are becoming more and more of these like careerist traps of like, here's the prosperity gospel. We're going to teach you how to be the best entrepreneur you can be.
Yeah.
And like,
oh God. Oh God. I just thought about that group. I won't say anything personal, but well, there are a lot of groups of people who are like making influencer magazines and stuff. And they like have this really, prefab model of communicating the identity politics that they're putting forth, and it's like very polished, and it's like, hey, why don't we dress as if we're already making money, and like also we're queer and colorful, and like, but then there's nothing after that. It's just sort of like staking a flag and saying we made it.
Like, yeah, where did they make it? I mean, it's, yeah, like
well, we can trick people with money to give us more money to sustain this product that we've, you know, prepackaged with a bunch of free labor and
lifestyle,
like,
support a lifestyle. I mean, I guess to me that's just the opposite of really like what comes up again in the book is just like the idea of a philosophy. Like, do you, is there a higher, the reason I think there's like God and stuff in the book is because it's this idea, well, we're stuck in this system at which there's only one goal, like, which is wealth, you know, to be on top of the system. But like, what about other value systems? What if, you know, what about other philosophies? I just don't ever hear artists talking about philosophy or like,
it's not good. It's really bad. It's it drives me nuts because it's just not, art school is not structured that way anymore. It's not structured in, you get a nice liberal arts education and an arts education. You know, it's really just like, we're going to teach you how to paint by numbers or whatever. And or
like reactive to what is out in the market. But it's not, I guess the whole, no, it's not going to be that way because of the way the administrations are running the art schools.
That's what we get into in the show a lot, is like the, like, it's like a lot of the professors are really great, right? But it's the way that you have to like kind of certify to become an administrator for in a school, within a school, is so deeply flawed that it just causes the whole school to be poisoned.
Yeah. Well, they came, that's what happened with Cooper Union. It was just taken over by horrible, greedy, bad management. And they tried to run it like any other building in Astor Place. And it's not, it's this idealistic institution founded on Jell-O, founded on a millionaire's largesse, you know, and they have real estate holdings. And so a lot of the book is like just about dealing with like the fact that, you know, I went to this idealistic institution and like there really was like amazing, like my teachers were amazing and like all art, like you can't hate the art teachers. They're stuck in the system too.
No,
and they're just trying to make
and
some
they're
bread
and often,
oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just saying they're often adjunct and don't get shit.
Exploited. You know, that's what I do for a living. So I have firsthand experience of like all these problems. So
I liked the part that you were illustrating, if the Cooper Union teacher that has understood that teaching is about paralysis of the student instead of like about enabling them to surpass the teacher. It's like,
yeah,
I don't
that's
know.
A fantasy. I mean, that's just this paranoid fantasy, but it's like people do feel that way because it's like, well, what else? Because they're stuck in the system. What are they going to do? Like either the student goes up or down past them and the teacher is not making their work or getting rewarded in the capitalist system. They found a niche in the school, which is sheltering them. And then maybe they can make work that is not necessarily like going to sell really well and they can be more idealistic. But
if we had a society that took care of each other and in particular took care of teachers, and the teachers could feel more grounded and secure in their profession and not have to like play both sides and I'm an adjunct professor and a working artist, it might make for a more wholesome education for for art students. But
I think that the advent of a more bureaucratic method in the art schools is definitely to blame, because like when I was at School of Visual Arts, my understanding of their history is that in the like their first accredited year was like 1973 or 74. And at that point, they had this thing that was just called like the experimental school, where you all, where a bunch of artists got together and lived in a sort of communal setting, and they like built their own housing, and they just like had consciousness raising classes, and they all like smoked weed out of like a window in the studio building. You know, it was just wild. And then by the time I graduated from there, it was like, everyone was incredibly stressed. People were like filling out all of these forms, and there were all of these weird legal issues going on with like a student who got a C but thought they wanted an A, and then their family was like from Korea wants to sue this teacher, and then it's like,
yeah, it's so what a nightmare. And it started out so good, and I think they all start out, like Black Mountain College is a good model, or the new school started out, with a really utopian kind of idea or progressive idea. And then it's like, I think as they try to survive in the marketplace, and they have to, these private universities.
Concessions, baby. That's what neoliberalism is all
concessions.
About.
Concessions.
Yeah, it's just eroding away at anything good about the institution, to where the point was with Cooper. It was like, why don't you just move it to Queens, is it really worth this building?
Oh,
and,
my God.
And like, so,
right.
If it's just an idea, an idea of a free school, I think is an incredible idea. And like, and people, have total, like, what I wish is that, more people were just starting schools or trying to figure out how to, like, I guess like the free university happened a couple years back, or Bruce High Quality, or whatever. Those are people trying to do new models. And like, but it's like, how do you do? In the book, it's like people are always sort of falling, the new models are falling apart or eating each other. Like the art handlers are like fighting each other over trying to find solution. And they're basically just like the left, they're like laboring left, like fencing with each other ultimately.
Right.
Because it's like, it's really hard. Like you can't run a pirate. What are you going to do? Have a pirate ship? Have a pirate village or something? Or like,
well, now we have podcasts, so we're kind of we're like one of the educational offerings available in your podcatcher. Like you could get into it. I've learned a lot. We were just talking about this one, Revolutionary Left Radio, which is super informative and awesome. They do so much research, and like, you can get these views on someone like Stalin, who you don't really know that much about except for that he's bad and scary, but who knows why, and you can listen for 3 hours about the intricacies of the way that actually like the Nazis were in charge of a lot of these narratives that we're hearing about this figure, and like how much of the misinformation was coming from his government versus like German government or like from
right,
the Ukraine,
and it's hard to overstate how much more scary like Churchill or like United States presidents are, more scary or as scary as like any other
demonized figure like Hitler. You can get educated.
No,
you can. I guess the point is like a podcast is a free space, an open space. You can educate yourself.
It's interesting.
You can overeducate yourself. You can bathe in information.
I don't know. Yeah,
content,
we're just really on this 3 hour long Stalin episode. But he has other. I only want to say to people that he has other episodes about Trotsky, about Mao, about
everybody,
and bunch of anarchist episodes, they're sort of like a popular front, left radio. Education,
all equally informative.
Yeah.
But then if you have that information, like I guess the important thing is like, what do you do in action to like, because I think there's sometimes like an idea, well, we'll just like talk about it or create more information about it or more papers about it or write about it, and like meanwhile like everything is like falling to shit like in front of your very eyes. It's getting harder to like, like you guys could be on the radio, like NPR or something, funded, and I mean, like, I'm just thinking like the space might get narrower as we continue. This is what I worry about is like, instead of like making, I don't know, what do you do? How do you take action?
Right. Well, I don't know. Yeah. I think we have a lot of criticisms of like certain extremely popular leftist podcasts for not using their resources in more holistic or collectivist ways. I think that we should be imagining models for like, well, we've been traveling around asking the question, what would a unionized art world look like? And it's like, it's hard to talk about like art jobs without talking about like advertising jobs, and then also talking about media jobs. And like it's hard to like frame things to people in a way that's like, well, it's like it's important for your advertising job to be unionized, but ideally, like, if there were to be a socialist revolution, we probably wouldn't need advertising anymore, and so we'd have to adjust in the future. But
yeah, once we're able to better communicate a like a disarmament between factions of the left,
yeah,
then we will be able to see a more like cohesive front in, you know, trying to survive at this point, because everyone has agreed that there is not a lot of time to figure out how to move. And there's definitely something that's going to happen, and nobody really knows what or when, but it's kind of like, okay, if we all keep talking about what we see and how we feel and try to piece together what a sensical narrative is, like what, instead of like piecing apart the propaganda, then at least we can start building like the basis of trust that will be necessary for when our economy like utterly collapses.
Yeah. Well, I think in that way, like I've been reading about, you know, bubbles, like the, you know, the tulip bubble and stuff
that,
and thinking, well, can it just keep sustaining? So maybe the art world is a bubble,
right,
that will sort of predict the bursting of, I've been thinking, you know, what if it does go away and like all of these jobs sort of like go away? But then I think a way to like, I think artists should sort of just take it upon themselves to make work that isn't for that market, that like, you know, can't be collected or doesn't create value in that same way. Like, I mean, like making a book, I mean, there's no way that my book is going to become an art object, you know, it's like a mass produced object. And then like talking and creating places where this can be talked about is one way of like ensuring, like trust, networks, even so you can have that language instead of like everybody being like, yeah, what's up? Yeah.
Also, that's
no one's really talking and people are using their minds and like articulating like their what's on their mind.
But then the comics and zines communities can be pretty messed up in different ways too. So like I'm very interested in building like, you know, alternatives to things that are explicitly anti-capitalist. Like I've ran a zine fair for like 4 years in the Silent Barn. That was like very explicitly anti-capitalist, and like, but we were only able to do it on like a small scale. And like, I think what we're seeing now is kind of it's gotten kind of out of control, and like capital has found a way to rear its head, as it always does, within these like comics communities to like gut people for way too much money for things like, you know, these big tabling events. Like they will take place in like an institution or a library, so you know they could be getting some sort of deal with the school if they worked it out in some way where they wouldn't have to be charged rent, and like, you know that there's some way to do it so that the artists aren't being gutted for things, like, and just always coming out like in the red. And it's just like, well, you have to do the fairs because that's the only way to gain an audience. So it's like this ethereal money that you're making in the future, maybe.
Yeah. Right. And then people have to travel. And yeah. I mean, the only like really interesting thing I've heard recently is like in Columbus with Crossroads Chicago and Tom Spurgeon, who is involved with that. And I think, you know, they have some money from like a wealthy cartoonist, you know, Jeff Smith. And he lives there, and they're like, he's on the board, and I don't know what. So anyway, but what they're trying to do is like have, you know, a festival that is also on the back end, like providing support for artists, or like, you know, optical, like a clinic, you know, or like just give away money to people in terms of prizes, or just have healthcare sign up, you know, like just ways to help people rather than like just like a festival of selling, which right. which like European festivals are more like art shows, you know, and everything's paid for and subsidized. And
like
it's not really about selling. Yeah, it's more like, I mean, the American model is just like another yeah. marketplace.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's all run by small business tyrants who are like just trying to figure out a way to subsidize their like really expensive rents and things. And like, I get that, like, it's just something's gonna have to give, because it's not, some of these fairs are, it's not I'm
it's exploitive. You know, I think the goal, if we were to be quite clear about our interests, is redistribution of wealth. And if we can concentrate on a couple of ways that we can make like a short-term plan and a long-term plan and stick to it, and sort of then like manage the emotions around these plans, like, because everyone yeah. is invariably going to want to have that cathartic moment where they just lose themselves in like the despair of capitalism. But really, it's like, we can firstly keep communicating to build trust. We can start to build plans, like pipelines towards this concept of a union, how we would be able to make this into an actual supportive network, and then figure out ways to use this force to, you know, bargain and demand our rights, and, you know, stop looking to representatives that are not keeping our livelihood in the forefront of their politics.
Yeah,
and then
the politicians, they don't understand how it's like everybody's like drank the NPR Kool-Aid about like
the world is getting better.
The world's getting better. The jobs are great. Like the unemployment rate is as low as it's ever been, and like, it's like all of us who's actually living in the precarity of juggling like three different jobs and like trying to make ever rising rent when wages are getting worse or stagnating, knows that it's not true and that something's going to give soon. And so we need to start at like taking care of each other and making our own structures outside of the political sphere.
Yeah, I think also, and like, you don't have to wait for the union to be established before you go on strike. You can just
yes.
be like, I'm quitting working for this asshole. I can live in my car. I can live.
But it
know.
Is hard to ask people to live in their cars.
We actually have gotten there on this podcast.
The goal is comfort. And, well, but I mean, I'm just using that as an example of like real taking. Doing something really idealistic instead of just sort of like, you know, griping and whining about how terrible things are, how expensive or shitty New York is. It's like, well, you need to then step back and just be like, maybe I should, you know, like be really poor right now and sacrifice like in
some
way.
No, it's crazy hearing you say this, because like we've had episodes where we literally get into like, we try to ask people to consider like, should I keep my shitty exploitative job to keep my one bedroom in New York, or should I do something to try to make the job better? And if I get fired, then have a contingency plan where maybe I will share a room, maybe mm-hmm. I will get rid of my car. Like, what are things that like if I try and fail, I can, maybe I have more of a safety net than I actually even realize.
Do y'all know about the people who made the Cool Bus? The Cool Bus is actually a fixture of this neighborhood we're currently in. It's, you'll see it now that you've heard it. It's actually, it's like one of those little short school bus things, you know. It's like got the S like and the H scratched out, so it just says cool bus on it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then inside is this, they've like refurbished the whole thing so that there's a tiny place to cook. There's like these bunk beds. They have a couple of pet cats who travel around with them, and they're all around lovely people. They speak in sign language. And yeah, there's ways to live that actually you can see. There's like a little documentary that my friend Jeff Seal made, so you can like check out the whole living situation. It actually is quite pleasant.
I think not having, I mean, being mobile or you know, not having property or a studio, having a different idea of a studio. I mean, that goes back to like, you know, what kind of work you're making. Maybe you're making, you know, woven, you know, carpet narratives that you can do on your lap as you like sit on a rock or maybe, you know, why do you need to make paintings, you know, for what market? It's like, maybe you're not a painter, or maybe there's no reason to be a painter. I mean, the idea of like what art is going to adjust to what you do. Like, I mean, I made comics because I didn't have money to make, you know, expensive video art like Matthew Barney, but I still wanted to make like crazy narratives. So it's like, yeah. I think thinking about, I mean, an artist like, you know, Andrea Zatel or doing stuff like that, making that part of their
work. We were just at the Harry Who show in Chicago, and we were in Chicago.
Oh,
and
so dope.
Gladys
Nelson.
There was a little blurb that I think like spoke volumes about why she was doing watercolors, and it was because she got pregnant, and then she switched to a less toxic way to make art so she could still take care of her child and do art.
With a baby on your lap, you can still paint, watercolor.
And end up in a museum. Fancy that.
Well, anything could end up in a museum.
Right.
The idea of like what can be there as being sculptures like is ridiculous, because there's all kinds of, I mean, and even just like making, you know, making comics and narrative art is never going to be in there, because it's like, it's just too mobile. It undermines this idea of investment. It's more empathic, you know, and storytelling. And
well, they had a whole comic section from the Harry Who, like all of their print material was in those great glass
cases.
That's
sort of how they do it now.
Like, well, those are like sort of quasi narrative. I would say that's quasi narrative. It's not really like, it's not for the people. It's not like a mass produced item. It's not like a film. It's not like music. You know, that kind of art I feel like is like,
do you feel like the New York Art Book Fair undermines a lot of like zine or comics mobility or accessibility?
Shots fired.
I don't really understand why they kind of ghettoize the comics section. Yeah, like the and then you've got the expensive stuff in the big house.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then you got the comics out back, you know, in the fields.
Yeah,
like I think that's
the big house. The
New York Art Book Fair. I don't really understand the popularity of the art book fairs. I think what it is like there's just a population of young people who are kind of like in the art world, but they don't have a career, so they do these book fairs and they make kind of like, you know, tends to be like just like very surfacey, you know, photo zines and I don't know, whatever. Mm. There's
me,
great stuff.
To me, like, it feels like a gray area market of some people are there to get their copy of the edition of 50 of whoever that
Raymond
they collect.
Teddy Bones, first.
Every.
Yeah.
Or not even that, like even like local.
Oh, like
interesting
friends
of ours, like anybody.
Raymond Pettibone Jr.
Like, well, yeah, there's good work there.
Son of Pettibone.
For sure. There's good work there for sure. I just don't understand why it's not the comic fair. I don't understand why all the New York art world celebs go to the art book fair and they would never go to CAB. It's like,
right.
You're a bunch of fucking, you know, elitist pricks who like have no interest
in
reading.
Well, SPX is always the
same
time.
In reading.
also.
Oh, yeah, right. So it's like in competition. Well, they're not going to drive down to Bethesda. I mean, of course, no one wants to be a nerd. They want to be like,
They're cool. Have a concert.
But it's like
Fancy taco.
If books are really cool, you know, fucking read, you know, read ElfQuest or not. That's a terrible example. Read, you know what I'm saying? It's like they want to go.
I
want to
have an anxiety
books,
attack
really...
at the New York Art Book Fair where everyone has cool shoes on.
Well, it's they've modeled.
What's her name's? Is the new, you know, Printed Matter? I don't know. Printed Matter. I've just like.
I have like that's the thing. I had so much criticism of the New York Art Book Fair, and I just keep being like, I'm gonna unleash my criticism every year, and then the dude died, and I'm like, oh. I guess I'll save that.
You killed him.
Sonel Breslav, who did the Bushwick Art Book Fair, which I exhibited at. It's not really my audience. It's like, it's not really my thing. I just feel like it's in neither here nor there. It's like not mass-produced stuff, and it's also not, you know, fine art objects. So I guess that's a comfortable area for a lot of people.
That's what I'm saying. It's a gray area. It's a wedge. It's a wedge.
Yeah.
And it's trying to undercut any, like, any more, like, holistic or, like, slightly, I don't know, more community-focused.
Well,
or...
it's a different philosophy of art making because if you have this coffee table book culture that is propagated by the art book fair, then there are still people who genuinely believe in like the singular image, and they think that this compilation of singular images ends up making like a more of a worldview than trying to sell someone a single photo or a single print or a single painting. So in a way, they are still trying to popularize the enjoyment you can receive from a fine art image, and I respect that because I collect art books. I'm like, I have my like first edition prints.
Art books too.
There is this thing
books.
Of like they're not ruining anything for me. They're like a weird tropical flower that I can't help but love. And
I think they're like, for everybody who can't have a gallery show, they can have a book that's kind of like a gallery show on a table or something like
that. Totally. Like and then like smoke show. Some weed and like look at the craziest pictures and see something different in them all the time. And like,
well,
you know,
it's the atomization of real estate too. It's like, it's, I don't know.
Splitting lots into smaller and smaller little.
Like at CAB, we're all going, five of us are going to split half of a fucking table because it's $250 for a half table.
That's insane.
Meanwhile, the most wealthy cartoonists get paid for free because they're the draw, right, guys? And just like.
It's like at Comic-Con when you see those booths that look like Lexus dealers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you've got to, you know, use a 3D printer to make a giant Antarctic ice cave to get anybody to buy your stuffed anime porn doll or whatever.
Oh, God.
Like, it's, I don't know. I don't know what to, fairs, it's all just corrupt. All you should do, I mean, I don't know what to do if there's no fairs. There don't need to be fairs. There don't need to be art galleries.
I'll do my Jack Smith impression again. The art fairs are a way for capital to... I don't even remember what he says about art fairs, but he has a whole ramble about art fairs being the... being like a way to make it easier for rich people. And then comic book fairs are supposed to be different from that, but they're increasingly not.
Yeah, right.
The art fair is the spawn of the lobster and Satan. And when you participate...
Fish hook. He stole
the
my,
real estate.
He took my table. He didn't pay me back the cost. Landlord is on the island. Well, I mean, yeah, well, like that guy, look, if that's your role model, prepare to die in poverty. I mean, that's the
hated
problem
and
with,
alone.
That's the problem with being an idealist is, everybody's going to hate you.
Yeah.
And you're going to get all your shit thrown away by your Christian relatives when you die. And one fifth of it.
And then Artist Space will gather up all the scraps from the literal trash.
His neighbor Penny Arcade would, and they'd form a foundation. But then, 10 years later, it's all being sold by... who bought his estate? Barbara Gladstone bought his estate. So it just enters the market.
Yeah.
There you go.
Back into
the market is patient.
Scraps. Yeah. The market's waiting for you.
Like a drooling wolf.
I don't know about Cab. I mean, I don't know about, I love Cab. I've exhibited there almost every year. It's expensive. I don't know what artists should do. I don't know what cartoonists should do. It is some sort of alternative, but you need to keep seeking, I guess, the alternative to the alternative, because who can travel anywhere? I mean, the only reason I could go to these fairs for the past 10 years, I mean, I went to some for like a couple years, but then I was like just coasting along with Picture Box, and now I'm coasting along with Drawn and Quarterly, and I do have a sponsor, I do have a patron, in that I have a publisher, so I don't know. I mean, for 5 years I just I would
you've also been teaching too.
I have subsidization through having a job that's like fairly
flexible, sort of.
Well, it's like, one day a seventh week of my work week.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, but I'm still broke.
Yeah.
So,
right.
You could get a third job.
I don't want a third job. I don't want to do it. I want to go Marcel Duchamp, smoke cigars, be slack, and have the. No, honestly, I mean, I'm.
No,
just...
I think it's incumbent on us who have carved out some sort of stable situation to make alternatives for the folks who do not. So that's why I really liked getting involved with the Festival Workers Association, because we're not just gonna sit back and pray that those at the very top adjust. Have to tell them what we want.
Yeah, make demands. I mean, and you've seen enough, and you've run enough organizations to know you have more experience than a lot of people do. And it is good to remember that you might feel in a position of what can I do? I don't even know anything. But you know more than you think you do, and you can help people. And then you can vampirically use their youthful energy to help you build the utopian igloo.
Whoa.
Matt is just on our wavelength. I knew it. It's so good.
I feel like, we've got a write in today from Lex. Lex wants to know what's up with the Space Tomato House.
Tomato House was a space that I ran with Rebecca Bird from...
And I interned at for a summer.
That's true. Yeah, working on Ian Gerson's show, making a spaceship.
It was so cool. We made a spaceship, modeled the spaceship and hauled all the pieces of plywood and cardboard. And then I helped book the opening show. We had some performances. It was really fun.
It was a good thing to do. I think it's a good... it's good for every artist to probably participate in running a space just to see what's on the other side, so you know how hard it is. And it's defunct. I mean, the short answer is it is no more. I no longer live there. But that energy, I'm sure, is there's always been countless artist-run spaces and apartment spaces and in New York, and that's one really good thing about the city is there's just so many artists that people are let's put on a show, and they'll do it in McDonald's or in
we had a show in a daycare, my gallery collective. It's great.
It doesn't need to be for money or career. It's just to like a salon almost, to show work and to celebrate yourself. And
in Chicago we just showed at an occult store.
It was great.
Every place can be a venue. I mean, all these places are probably more interesting.
All these venues could have art in them.
Or all these artists could be occultists. Yeah. And they could maybe learn something from the daycare or the occult or the places that they're...
The daycare of the occult?
Or they,
totally.
Maybe it should go both ways, where the artists are learning carpentry. But
Yeah.
Yeah, no more Tomato House. As far as curating, I'm just, I started a 60mm film club in the Catskills. So I've been obsessed with film and showing materialist film on film, but not so much art. I don't know. I kind of liked, it was weird working with your friends and like, then you're like in one role and your friends are in the artist role. And that can be like a little, that can be interesting. It definitely is like role playing when you are the manager of a space and people are like looking to you to do things or answer questions or kind of like, you know, represent them in a way. Or so that's good to go through with people, but I don't know. I'd put in my time doing that. I wouldn't really want to run a space right now. I would run a movie theater. I'd like to run a movie theater. That would be really, that's like my still my dream, or like a workshop, you know, shared equipment space where you make the stuff and then there's a venue. That does still interest me, but no more Tomato House. It was a good run.
Well, and you just got back from tour. Touring your book in different comic stores throughout the U.S. Are you doing any more stops or are you done?
I'm doing a talk at CAB, which will be a longer version of the same lecture with more interference patterns.
Oh, that's great, because I missed the one at Desert Island because I got sick and I had to get better before going to Chicago. But yeah, I was really glad.
See it in its ultimate phase.
Yeah, because your stage or performance stuff is always really neat to catch, and that's really exciting. And I guess we should wrap up there. Any final thoughts, Lucia?
Nope. No thoughts.
Not one.
Zero thoughts.
Do we have anything on the horizon? We have a show, right?
Oh,
we're in a show.
Yes. We just booked a show at the new Do Something.
Joey, can you get the Do Something drop and put it in there?
Damn, son, where'd you find this?
Do Something.
But it's the new Do Something with Allison Brainard, and it's going to be November 13th. So
I forgot where it is.
Get into
New Women's Space. New Women's Space is awesome.
Yeah. So
Right over there. Right,
we'll be there.
In the
we'll be doing bits. Something.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, everybody, let's have fun. See you next week.
Let's have fun.
Hope you enjoyed our first guest. Thanks, Matt,
Yay.
So
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having me.
You're
Thank you
awesome.
So much.
Thank
Thanks.
You.
It was really fun. Thank you.
Bye.
Lots of fun.